everyone to a certain extent is ideological, but do you want to force other people to live by your view of the world? That's a different thing.
Today is Karlyn Borisenko, an organizational psychologist and owner of Zen Workplace, where she helps individuals gain greater happiness through mindfulness and other techniques. But also, she's a controversial, outspoken libertarian, often found furiously debating with people on all sides of the political spectrum on Twitter. She's a lot of fun and is now the Libertarian Party nominee for governor of New Hampshire. She gained notoriety after attending a Trump rally in 2020 and writing an article about this. She did so as a Democrat of 20 years and changed her mind about the Democrats. I don't think she's become this super big Trump fan. She seems to really see a lot of his flaws. And I should just add here that I'm certainly not a Trumpy person myself, but the experience changed how she felt about her own group, the Democrats, and what she saw as hatred among them. She tells me today about her new book called Actively Unwoke, The Ultimate Guide for Fighting Back Against the Woke Insanity in Your Life. It's out in July 2022 and already available for pre-order, so get hold of that on Amazon or wherever you get your books. And she'll be talking about what it means to be truly libertarian. Like with all my guests, I trust you and your opinions about the thing that they're talking about. Personally, I love a lot of the ideals of libertarianism. It means a lack of intrusion from government. And if you take it to its extremes, it really means a lot of freedom to live in small pockets of land in the way that you want to live. Joe Rogan is often an advocate of this kind of libertarianism. But it does come with its perils. In the interview, I allude to a town where bears took over. I couldn't remember the full story, and I've looked it up now since the interview. I heard it from John Ronson, and there's a book called A Libertarian Walks Into a Bear by Matthew Hongoltz Hetling, about a group of libertarians in New Hampshire, the very place Karlyn is a nominee for governor, who got rid of local government only for bears, black bears, to move in. This was the Free Town Project in the town of Grafton, where a bunch of libertarians who found each other through shared values online moved there and got rid of taxes somehow. They used the teachings of Ayn Rand, among others, and figured they could live from logic and reason alone. New Hampshire is the so-called live free or die state. It has the highest per capita machine gun ownership and imposes no income or sales tax. And so, 200 free radicals moved to Grafton, mostly with guns and things. However, the black bears became emboldened as there was no state patrol to ward them off. Nobody paid for or mandated bear-proof garbage bins. They started hanging out in people's gardens, and some of the locals fed them. Unlike most black bears, these ones weren't scared off anymore by loud noises. They weren't easily run off by humans. Chickens and sheep began to disappear in the night at alarming rates, and household pets went missing. One local was playing with her kittens outside when a bear came along and snatched two of them away and ate them. And soon, the bears started entering homes and attacking humans. The libertarian group were powerless to do anything about the problem, because who do you call when you've gotten rid of the taxes that pay to take care of this kind of thing? In fact, residents even argued about whether anything should be done at all. True libertarian values, some said, meant doing precisely nothing. One woman, who goes by Donut Lady, took to feeding the bears grain topped with, you guessed it, sugared donuts. That's why she's called the Donut Lady. The kind of thing that appeared easy to solve in the abstract debates of the message boards that brought the libertarians together and to Grafton were much harder to work out in real life. The bear issue was pretty unique, but it happened, and it's a cool metaphor, really, for why libertarianism, like any ideology, when taken to its extreme, hasn't found a way to work. You could say, oh, well, let's actually pay a bit of taxes to work out a system to stop the bears. But then it's like, oh, okay, well, then what about also for this other thing and another thing? And before you know it, you're back to paying taxes, or you're not, and bears are eating your kittens. That said, I was fascinated to find out the theories behind libertarianism, and Carlin was great at explaining them. This is the podcast for curiosity, not judgment, and you can make up your own minds if you want. There are compelling reasons for wanting less state intrusion. That is evident. I wish Carlin the best of luck in her endeavours and hope to see her become governor of New Hampshire, because why not? Follow her on Twitter on Dr. Carlin B and subscribe to her extremely popular YouTube channel by searching her name. She does live streams all the time and is a lot of fun. I've been on her show as well. You are on the edge of society, in a micro nation of a podcast with Carlin Borisenko. Been doing a lot of stuff about cults recently, right, and cult leaders and ideologies and all that kind of thing. Do you ever get the impression we're all just idiots just sort of following around ideologies until we die? Do you ever feel like that?
Oh, I feel like that all the time. And it's not even about, you know, whether you're on the left or the right or conservative or liberal. I kind of feel like I'm surrounded by people who are in their own separate cults and tribes on a constant basis. And I'm the odd man out because I don't buy into that nonsense at all. And it's a very odd feeling once you come to that realization.
Yeah, it's just like, do you have a sports team, anything like that, that's like your thing where you have your cult?
Well, no, I mean, my thing is, so my favorite athletic event of all time is the Boston Marathon. I went to school in Boston. The Boston Marathon's an iconic race. I've run the Boston Marathon twice. And it's just like, it's one of those things that when you're running and marathoning, it's a very individualized sport. So it doesn't have the same kind of like cult-like team environment as you would see like football or basketball or any of those things. So no, I don't really have a tribe like that. It's not something I've ever really understood.
It's a really funny example, that one. And I mean, funny, not in ha-ha way, but obviously, I mean, I interviewed Jesse Morton, speaking of ideological people, who was the former terrorist, jihadi terrorist, who cooked up the ingredients, or he made the ingredients for the Boston Marathon bomb.
No kidding.
Yeah. He converted to the other side and then worked to stop people being terrorists. And a few months ago, he died. And nobody seems to know why, but he was only 40-something. He was found by his kids. It was very sad.
Well, that's one of those things. So my husband and I were actually at the Boston Marathon bombing. We were a block and a half away from the second bomb when it went off, and was probably one of the more terrifying and traumatic experiences of my life, which is how I ended up running the marathon. I ran the 2 years following the marathon bombing. And so, I mean, that whole thing, I mean, it's like, that whole thing is still kind of a mystery for me. And I feel like there's so much, because I mean, I red-pilled in 2020, and it's one of those things when you red-pill that like, you start to go back and relitigate every major event and news story in your life to figure out, what was the media telling me the truth on? What were they lying to me about? And the Boston Marathon bombing is not one that I've broached yet, because it's still a pretty traumatic thing for me to think about.
Yeah, I bet. Well, I won't ask you too much about that then. I was going to, but then you said it's traumatic, and I thought, oh, I'm not going to.
That's okay. You can ask if you want, but you know. I might twitch a little bit. It's okay.
I was going to ask what it was actually like to be there, but then I also thought the word red pill. I'm concerned about that, just because a lot of my audience is very general and very large and different, and some people will know what that means. And I think we've used the word with incels, for example, when we had incels on here. What does red pill? And I, you know what? That's a good segue to go into your sort of Trump rally story. Do you want to tell your story and how it relates to the word red pill?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was a Democrat for 20 years and never really thought anything of my political ideology until social justice and woke insanity started to take over my knitting community. Like, it's knitting with like the needles in the yarn. And you know, it sounds funny to say it out loud, and it still does to this day. But it was actually pretty serious. There were like these roving band of social justice warriors that were running around in the knitting community, threatening people if they weren't using the language they wanted them to use, making them write formal apologies for writing blog posts about being excited about vacationing in India, because if you vacation in India, you are a colonizer, and that should be apologized for. But one guy actually got bullied and mobbed so badly that he ended up in the hospital on suicide watch. And when this happened, and his only offense was like writing a poem saying, we should probably be kinder to each other than we're being right now. And he posted it on Instagram and got mobbed relentlessly for weeks after that. And, you know, that was kind of my wake up call, was seeing this happening and seeing these people that I had politically aligned myself with just acting like insane people over words and things that just didn't make sense to me at all. And at that point, I just started to question everything about what I knew. And I started challenging myself to try to listen to voices that I thought I would disagree with. And my husband actually helped me out with this, because he said to me, my husband was always a closet conservative, but I never knew it because we don't really talk about politics as part of our marriage. And he said to me one day, he was like, Carlin, why don't you listen to Ben Shapiro? And I said, no, Victor, Ben Shapiro is Satan. I will never listen to Ben Shapiro.
And then he left the house one day, and I did the thing where, like, I made sure he was gone. I locked all the doors. I drew the shades to make sure no one would see me. And then I turned on Ben Shapiro, and it turned out that he wasn't Satan. He was actually just a normal conservative saying normal conservative things. And I was like, huh, why did I think this guy was the worst guy in the history of humanity? Now, I don't agree with him on everything, but he's not like a bad, horrible person. And that kind of started me on this journey of challenging myself to listen to other people I thought I would disagree with. And I ended up discovering the Walkaway movement, which is which I had actually heard about on MSNBC. I had heard that they were people who were faking being former Democrats leaving the left. But no, it turned out they were real. And so I just started really getting into all this stuff about people who had woken up and realized how much they were lied to by the Democratic Party and the news media and all of that. And that's really how I define red pilling, by the way. I don't define it as being a conservative or anything like that. And we can talk more about that. But I ended up at a Donald Trump rally not too far away from my house the night before the New Hampshire primary in 2020. And this was a big challenge for me, because I was scared of Trump supporters. I really was. But I was like, you know what? This is your fight. You've been doing this little exercise of listening to people you disagree with for months. Now you're going to go into the wild. You're going to go and actually experience it in real life. And I got my courage up to go and stood in line for hours outside and started talking to people. And lo and behold, they were really nice and they were welcoming. And even sometimes I would say, you know, I'm a Democrat. And they're like, oh, my God, welcome. We're so glad you're here. And I was so jarred by the entire experience of having a really, really fun time at this Trump rally around all these people that were really excited and just really nice and generous and kind, that I wrote an article about it. And it just posted it on Medium, not really thinking anyone would ever read it except maybe my friends and family. And you know, a week later, 3.3 million people had read it. It had been retweeted by Donald Trump Jr., all the Fox News hosts, all that stuff. And so that was kind of this moment where I got thrust into this whole little world, and was certainly, I mean, and continued my red pill journey, I think, to this day. Because like I said, I define red pilling as just waking up to the fact that there are a lot of people that are lying to you about what's going on. And you start to be able to learn to see the truth in what's happening simply based on oftentimes what the media is not telling you. So it's not a political stance. It's just about waking up and seeing the world for as it is.
It comes from The Matrix, right? Or did The Matrix take it from something else?
Well, I think most people think it came from The Matrix. I think that's the homage that most people pay. The producers of The Matrix, I think, don't really like that. And I think they tried to take the whole red pill thing back with the last movie. But the last movie sucked, so who really cares?
I didn't watch it. I mean, the trailer looked like the worst thing I've ever seen ever, and it looked like they couldn't be bothered to act or direct or anything. They're super woke guys as well. Not guys anymore But you can say guys for women, so that's, I think I would, ooh, say to a bunch of women, hey guys.
Well, you know, it's funny because around the time that my knitting community got taken over by social justice warriors, my little group of friends actually staged a separate intervention for me, because they said I'd been using too much gendered language, and I was calling people dude that weren't men. Obviously, I used to say guys like you just did, and they didn't like that. So I actually had an intervention staged around that type of language as well.
How did the intervention go? Was it like you come home like, oh, God, what a day? And then they're all sitting there like, oh, we need to talk to you, Carlin.
That was basically what happened. happened is I was working on, I mean, they chose the worst possible time to try to do this, because I was working on like three big projects for my business that I was like, I have no time, I have to focus. And then all of a sudden I get this Facebook Messenger intervention from all of them messaging me at the same time. And they're like, Carlin, we have to talk about your gendered language. And I was like, what the hell? I'm busy. I can't talk right now. And they just kept going. They're like, well, this is not acceptable. And they just kept going. And I basically told them, listen, I am not going to have an intervention staged over Facebook Messenger. If you guys want to have this conversation, we can get on Zoom like normal people and have a conversation, but we're not doing it over Facebook Messenger and we're not doing it right now. Goodbye. And they didn't like that too much and I never heard from them again.
Isn't it funny how, or ironic, how often people who may have been red-pilled or have moved a little bit towards the center at least would have had experiences just like that from the very people who are trying to recruit them further towards whatever. And I don't want to say left, because it's not left-wing, because I've interviewed plenty of left-wing people on here who can't stand the whole woke thing. Katie Herzog was an example recently, and she's she talks about a similar thing where her friends just, well, her friends just wouldn't speak to her. They shunned her, which is something I'm seeing a lot of in Jehovah's Witnesses that I've been speaking with, just the shunning and stuff. She was just totally shunned. They just turned their backs on her. So it's not a left-wing thing. It's just because, would you say that maybe 30, 40 years ago, it was more from the right, this kind of like canceling and stopping people from speaking their minds and that kind of thing?
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up, because I literally just had a conversation with a conservative on my channel, I think last week or the week before, where we were talking about this, where, one of the reasons I became a Democrat was because I hated Republicans in the 90s. I hated them. They were always trying to tell me about like what music I couldn't listen to and what art I couldn't look at. And you can't watch this and you can't watch that. And let's cancel all violent movies and all violent video games. And we were actually talking on my channel the other day about how conservatives were the original cancel culture, because they canceled the Dixie Chicks when the Dixie Chicks came out against W, and it was this whole big rigmarole. And so absolutely. I mean, I think what we see going on in culture is just one side backlashing against what the other side is doing, and they get really horrible, and then the other side backlashes against them, not because any of them are standing on any sort of principled positions, but because they're just fighting back against the other tribe. And it just goes back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. And it's incredibly predictable to watch it play out. It's like anytime anyone on the left says anything, well, it's very predictable that conservatives are going to say exactly the opposite of that thing, no matter how horrible the exact opposite of that thing actually is, and then vice versa. And it almost feels a little hopeless sometimes. Like, is it even possible to stop just this tit for tat thing that's going on?
Yeah, I think that's why I started with saying, like, are we just idiots, just all saying things at each other? That, because also my American history is not very good, but I think, am I right in saying that like back in the slavery days, it was the other way around, as that you might expect it as well? Like the Democrats and the Republicans, Republicans were swapped around, kind of thing.
Yes, to a certain extent. I mean, there's debate on whether or not the flip happened between the parties, and I don't really care either way, to be honest, but it was even more vicious back then. Have you ever heard of Bleeding Sumner? Have you come across this?
Sumner.
Yeah. So Charles Sumner was a senator in Massachusetts. And this was, I think, it was either during the Civil War or right before the Civil War, where he actually ended up getting attacked and beaten over the head with a cane on the Senate floor because he was opposed to slavery. And it's actually immortalized in a statue in Harvard Square, and they called it Bleeding Sumner. So it used to actually be more vicious. We used to actually be hitting each other. Yeah.
That's Sting's last name. The singer Sting is Gordon Sumner.
Really? I didn't know that.
Mm. Yeah. Mm. Might be a long lost relative. Yeah. Yeah.
That'd be funny.
That is funny. It's not related to Sting, is it? It's just not. I'm going to have to admit that.
You tried.
Yeah. I wonder if it's a case of like a lot of people, as you get a bit older, seem to go away from the wokey stuff. Does that happen? I don't know. I'm thinking out loud. Is that a thing?
I mean, I think maybe it was once a thing. I think that we used to assume that people would like graduate from college and go out and get a job in the real world, and they would be set straight because they would have to go to a job and be professional, and that's the only way they can afford to live. But unfortunately, now a lot of corporations are integrating this training into their workplace. And so they don't have to give it up after they leave college. So I think it may have been true at one point that people would grow out of it. But I think we're also in the midst of seeing like the first generation of people who have had this ideology reinforced in the workplace following college. I mean, I started seeing this. I'm an organizational psychologist by trade, and I started seeing this probably around like 2017, 2018, showing up in young professional coaching clients that I was working with in just different agencies and things like that. And so I really think we're on the very beginning of like, what does this actually look like when this is reinforced as an adult? And do I think they're going to give it up? Well, no, because we see it all the time that they just continue to double down and double down and double down. And now, I mean, again, I think there's woke on the left and I think there's woke on the right. And we see the right backlashing against the woke on the left. And I see a lot of actually many more older people on the right backlashing against woke on the left, but they end up acting in exactly the same way. They use exactly their same tactics of cancel culture and struggle sessions and things like that. So I don't know. I kind of think we're pretty screwed. You know, if we can just laugh about it in the meantime, I guess that's our only option.
Hey, it's Andrew. If you're enjoying Heretics, there's another podcast I want to recommend to you, especially if climate change, global conflicts, and an upcoming election are making you feel like we're on the brink of disaster. What Could Go Right is hosted by Progress Network founder Zachary Carabel and executive director Emma Varvalukas. On What Could Go Right, the hosts sit down with expert guests to discuss the world's most pressing issues without resorting to pessimism or despair that we hear so often. Instead, they look back at how far society has come and look forward at what it will take to achieve an even brighter future. Is progress on the way? They may not have all the answers, but on What Could Go Right, they're asking the key questions. Tune in to hear interviews with upcoming guests like writer Coleman Hughes, CNN host Fareed Zakaria, and economist Alison Schrager. If you're looking for a weekly dose of optimistic ideas from smart people, join them every Wednesday on What Could Go Right, available wherever you get your podcasts. How might we, for those who, I mean, I guess most listeners now are probably familiar with the whole woke thing by now. It's been a couple of years. I've done quite a few episodes on it. But how might you crystallize like what it essentially is, especially when it's quite interesting to hear you talk about woke culture on the right as well. That's really interesting.
I mean, I think for me, how I crystallize it is it's an authoritarian mindset of people who want to be the dictator of how you live your life. I don't think that woke is a left or right concept. I think it's on the different axis of authoritarianism versus libertarianism. And there can be authoritarians on both the left and the right.
It drives me mad. I've always had that thing as well. And I think I see something in you and other people, probably a lot of people who listen to this podcast, for example, and yours, for example, as well, who maybe just can't stand that kind of being told what to do. Some people quite enjoy it. And I wonder if we have to accept that as well, to an extent, that if this was Lord of the Flies and we're all on that beach or whatever, and we're just, you know, if there's a certain amount of people voting for how we want the world to be, some people want it to be extremely societal and extremely like, these are the rules, these are the things to do. And that there is something, I don't want to say American about it, because America's obviously very individualistic as well, and freedom. America's just so, such an amazing, incredible, huge, big country that has just every extreme, doesn't it? But I remember going to a kids camp when I was 19 in California, and I was looking after all these kids and stuff, and just that sort of that tradition of just like, we're all singing songs and I pledge allegiance to the flag and all that, like we're all a community, and I hated it, and I don't know why. And I guess there's just a lot of us who are just very individualistic and we don't like that stuff, right?
Well, I think that's part of it. You know, I mean, we actually talk about this a lot. I'm very involved with the libertarians in New Hampshire. I'm a member of the Libertarian Party in New Hampshire. We are the best libertarian party in all of the country.
What does libertarian mean?
Basically, leave us alone. We basically want to get rid of as many government things as possible, defund as much of the government as possible. And in New Hampshire, we actually have political power because 25% of the House of Representatives at the state level are actually libertarians. They're registered as Republicans, but they're libertarians. And so we talk about this quite a bit in terms of like, we've had conversations about, we don't care if people want to be communists. We just don't want them living around us. If people want to go possibly to the state of Vermont and form their own little communist society in the state of Vermont and leave us alone, then we have no problem with that, because people should be allowed to live however they want to live. And if someone wants to be part of a communist society, that is their choice. And as long as they're not enforcing that on us through the force of the state or law or anything like that, then who are we to say that you can't live the way you want to live? And that's actually what's going on in New Hampshire, is we have what's called the Free State Project here. So we're basically trying to get as many libertarian minded people to move to New Hampshire as possible so we can gain as much political power as possible to be able to make the changes that we want. We are the number one freest state in the country. We're the only state in the country last year that actually we cut back on taxes. We cut our budget. It was the most libertarian budget in the history of the state. And we also actually have something that's called the Progressive State Project, which is, if you are a progressive that lives in the state of New Hampshire, we will pay to move you to a progressive state. Like, we will actually pack up your stuff and move you to Massachusetts or move you to Vermont, because we don't think progressives are going to be happy here, and we're going to be happier with them gone, and they're going to be happier in their own little progressive paradise.
Yeah, but Carlin, who would you debate then? Who would you have these kind? I sometimes, when I'm doing the work, and I'm going to go outside of politics here, but just looking at like people who are like abusive priests and horrible people, and this is going to sound bad, but I just, it is what it is, I'm quite happy that they exist, because I get to either make documentaries about them or watch documentaries and films about these people or meet people and get annoyed at them. If you're all sitting there, and also, you know, this will happen, like if you had this state of just all you people who think roughly the same, you'll start to find small differences, because that's just humanity, isn't it? You find the small differences and they become enormous, right?
Well, yeah, but the thing is, we don't actually think the same. We just mutually agree that we shouldn't be in charge of each other's lives, and that I should be able to make my decisions the way I want to, and you should be able to make yours, and we will respect each other's rights to do that, and we share that common set of values. So I wouldn't say that this is not like an echo chamber. There's not universal belief, but what we do agree on is the state should not be enforcing their will on any of us. And other people don't have that right either. I love that you make documentaries about dark things, because I think dark things are fascinating to look at. But am I going to invite those dark things into my house? No, probably not.
I would. What about? Okay, boring centrist dad's question. I'm not a dad though, but don't you need a bit of everything? Don't you need, I mean, taxes, that's something to pay for some stuff like roads. And the big thing that's like the big difference in America to say the UK is the NHS that we have, the National Health Service. Like the idea that if somebody falls ill, they could just die because they don't have the money. That just seems mad, maybe because I just haven't grown up in a different environment. Does that not seem mad? Shouldn't there be things like that?
I mean, don't you guys pay like over 60% of your income in taxes to be able to sustain that national health? I mean, why are you responsible for paying for that, the poor healthcare decisions of other people? I don't know.
It's not 60%.
Well, you should look that up, because I'm pretty sure it is pretty well, you might, it's, I don't pay state taxes in New Hampshire, so I don't know. But the thing of it is, it's like, we actually have the discussion about the roads all the time. And the first roads in New Hampshire were private. They were private and they maintained just fine as private roads. So no, we don't need the government to maintain these things.
Private roads, you say? Okay, I'll get to that. I'll just say, I'm just looking up and it's just Google, might be wrong. Oh no, it's actually the UK government website. Basic rate taxable income, 20% on between 12,000 and 50,000. And then if you're earning 50,000 to 150,000, it's 40%. And if you're owning over £150,000, it's 45%. It was 60%, I think, in the days of the Beatles. And this is the funny thing, because the Beatles, they have that song Taxman, which I think is complaining about how high the taxes and things are, which I don't think you'd ever have a popular rock band doing today, because they'd be slaughtered by everyone else. But they did that at the time. So it's not that high. And I think if I'm earning 150,000, which won't happen for some considerable time, I feel like I'd be happy to pay 45%, and especially because that 45% doesn't all go towards helping people be healthy and stuff. It's just an extra few percent. But also, do you want to live in a world where, like, oh, that person's got ill and they're poor, so they're just going to die on the street in front of me? Like, even if you are wealthy and, you know, it's not nice to see, is it?
No, but I also think you're making an assumption that just because I don't want the state to mandate me to pay for something, that I wouldn't do private charity. I mean, I got to be honest, like, the libertarians in New Hampshire are some of the most generous, helpful people that I've ever met in my life. They're always willing to pull out their wallet if someone needs it. We do fundraising events all the time. And so we're not opposed to helping people that legitimately need the help. We're just opposed to the state forcing us to help the people that the state claims needs the help, and then inevitably puts like additional administrative charges on top of that. So only a fraction of the money you're actually paying to help people ends up getting to the people who actually need it. I think we just believe in a more direct way of doing it.
Would you like to, like, what if you guys, like, went and lived on an island somewhere? Would you enjoy that, like, being away and, like, this is didn't that happen? Hang on, John Ronson, I went to see John Ronson recently, and he said there was somewhere in the States where they all went and they said, we are going to live completely libertarian. And that one woman in that community, it was a small community, she started feeding the bears, and then the bears started coming, and there's no sort of state intervention to say stop feeding the bears. And the bears, I think they killed her in the end or something like that.
Well, it seems like she was behaving a little irresponsibly then. I feel like I vaguely know what you're talking about, but no, I mean, in New Hampshire, we literally are trying to create our own libertarian island. I mean, we actually just had a vote on secession a couple months ago. It was the first vote on state secession since the Civil War.
What does it mean?
It means we actually wanted to break away from the United States and form our own independent country.
So exciting.
It was exciting.
Exciting for me to see, just like, oh, I remember when I first moved to Germany a few years ago. I'm back in the UK now. I lived in Germany for a while. I spoke to a flatmate I had originally, this woman from Germany, and I told her, oh, you know, Brexit or something. Well, I didn't really have strong opinions about it. And she'd never heard of it. And I said, like, yeah, the UK is going to move away from Germany. And she genuinely thought, 100% she thought they were moving the UK geographically. They're pushing it somehow further from mainland Europe. And I was staggered. And I had to move to a new flat because that was just ridiculous. But please go. So you're talking about that New Hampshire would just sort of be its own. That happens in Family Guy as well.
Yeah, we did have a vote on secession a couple months ago. And we're not the only state that's trying to do it. Florida actually has a pretty good secession movement, and actually California, believe it or not, because it's the progressive secession, because they want their own progressive paradise. But no, I mean, we generally think that states should be allowed to make their own decisions, and that if we can come to some sort of like mutual agreement that, you know, we're going to be able to trade and stuff, like, we're fine with that. But I don't know if you know this, I'm actually the libertarian nominee for governor in New Hampshire. And I have promised that if I am elected governor, I will build walls on our borders with Massachusetts and Vermont so that we can keep the riffraff progressives out, and we'll find a way to make Massachusetts pay for it.
Man, how much of this is stuff you're saying because it's funny and would be funny to do? And how much is it, like, if you actually get in, like, oh my God, I've got to do this now?
Well, certainly the building of the wall is probably a really audacious promise to make, if we're honest about it. But no, I am actually serious about some of the promises that I made. For example, I promised to write an executive order day one, putting a camera in every public school classroom in the state of New Hampshire to be able to monitor what the teachers are teaching students and live stream it right to parents of students in those classes. I've promised to defund every single program with the word equity in the title. I've promised to pardon all nonviolent victimless crime offenders and just release them from jail immediately. I promised to legalize weed and mushrooms and other like plant-based things. And I promised to make our property tax optional, because 66% of our property tax goes towards funding the public schools. And I don't think we should have to do that. And so I'll give people the choice of whether or not they want to pay it.
It's really interesting because the things that you're listing there, I think people will be listening. And because we are tribal, it's like we're looking to hear, like, oh, look at these typically traditionally right-wing things. But then there are like these left-wing things that are, well, traditionally left-wing. I mean, obviously they have nothing to do with the economy and like left or right in that sense. You know, legalizing those kinds of drugs and letting people out of prisons when they, you know, the non-violent crime thing, which I think, like, surely everyone's in favor of that. What we spend in taxes and things on prisons. That is something you need taxes for, though, prisons, right?
Well, oh, yeah, absolutely. And prisons are so expensive, and especially when you get into private prisons, not only are they ridiculously expensive, but they're also incredibly poorly run. And so, yeah, like, why do I care about locking up someone that sleeps with a prostitute? Like, if you don't want to sleep with a prostitute, don't sleep with a prostitute. But, like, don't tell other people what they can do with their bodies, I guess. Or, like, someone, like, for gambling or other stupid offenses like that, they haven't hurt anyone. I mean, you could argue that they've hurt themselves, but why are you sending them to prison for hurting themselves. That's just hurting them more. I don't think it makes any sense.
Yeah, I think I agree with that. I think I'm a bit libertarian, but I'm a bit more boring as a person. I'm less outspoken about a lot of it, and I'm more like, oh, but what about that? But I think I can't stand like anything. Just tell it. Like, I want to do a thing. I'm doing the thing. Why is it your problem? I'm doing it.
And I think for me, how I've thought about it is, I'm not all the way anarchist, although I tend to get more anarchist every single day as we watch our government just screw up repeatedly. But I kind of think that the libertarians right now are the only people that can pull us back from this authoritarian bend that we have on both the left and the right. And it's like, you know, there's Michael Malice says that conservatives are progressives driving the speed limit, because if the progressives do something, they're the conservatives following them just a couple years later, even though they said they wouldn't, then all of a sudden they are. And the only people that are saying the opposite of what the establishment is saying are the libertarians. And so it's not a perfect party by any means, although it's about to get a lot better in a couple of months when we take it over. But I really do think it's like one of those things that I don't necessarily believe in anarchy all the way, but I'm going to argue for it, because I think that if we argue for it, we're going to land somewhere in the middle. And that might be a better state to be in for everyone.
Yeah, it's, you found a way of being like extreme middle, right?
Yes. Yes.
Extremely moderate.
I think that's a really, well, I don't know. I mean, again, personally, I don't find myself to be extremely moderate, but I think that arguing the extreme on the other side is the only way to get to that moderate place.
It is complicated, isn't it? And also something you said earlier was that, you know, your mind has not been infected by this sort of parasite of ideology. But if you asked all of those people, they would say the same thing, right? If you ask anybody who's within the ideology, they will always say that they're the ones who don't have it. It's a little bit like a lot, again, I'm going back to Americans just because it's a different country to mine, but a lot of Americans I've met have always said that they don't have an accent, and they say, oh, you've got look at your accent, I don't have an accent. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, you don't have a, that's crazy. We never really, so how do I know, you know, how do I know that I'm not ideological?
That's a good question. I mean, I think we all are ideological to a certain extent. But again, I think it goes back to this idea that, do you want to force your ideology onto other people? I'm very ideological. I have very distinct judgments about many things, but I don't feel a tremendous desire to force my judgments and my view of the world onto other people. I frankly don't care if other people agree with me or not. And so I think that that's really the difference. It's not that everyone to a certain extent is ideological, but do you want to force other people to live by your view of the world? That's a different thing.
Ideological, but not evangelical.
Yeah, I think that's a good distinction.
Yeah, I think that's a good one as well. I mean, you could argue that the two of us as, you know, podcast hosts to an extent are trying to evangelize, even if we don't want to. Again, I spoke to John Ronson about this, and he gave me an answer I didn't expect. Do you know John Ronson?
No.
He, an English journalist, and he wrote The Psychopath Test about psychopaths, but he also wrote this really important book called, in the UK anyway, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which I think you'd really enjoy, actually. And it was, what's the word? Is it prophetic? What's the word when it's ahead of its time?
I think prophetic, yeah.
I get confused because it sounds like pathetic, and I don't want to say it's pathetic because it was really good. It was really ahead of its time, and because it was before the whole cancel culture really kicked in. And he went to examples like, did you hear that Justine Sacco, the woman on the plane,
yes.
PR woman? Who I'll just reiterate for listeners who don't know, but the PR woman who she wrote something on Twitter saying, going to Africa, hope I don't get AIDS. And while she was in the air on the plane, like, the world mobilized against her and like stalked her plane, turned up at the airport to like harass her. And she was actually making quite a progressive satirical joke about white people thinking only white people can get AIDS. Her life was ruined. You know, she couldn't get a job for years and years. So he talks to people like that in his book. So his whole book is about, you know, let's not moralize, because people on all sides, we all make mistakes, we're all human and all that kind of thing. And I asked him, like, so, you know, are you all about like not moralizing then? Is that your thing? Because that's what I like to do. I don't want to moralize. And he was like, I suppose I do moralize. That's the whole book is moralizing. I don't stop moralizing. So I guess it's like, you know, even if you're trying not to moralize and not be ideological and not be evangelical, particularly writers like John Ronson or podcast platform hosts like me and you, we probably sort of are moralizing.
I was just talking about this with my locals community yesterday, where we were wondering actually if we were trying to push our worldview onto other people by sheer virtue of the fact that we talk about it. And we're doing this, we do a group activity where we investigate school districts and then release embarrassing information on them to like try to delegitimize the public school. It's a fun group activity. But we were wondering, like, are we actually pushing our worldview onto other people? And I think that, again, I think there's a difference between expressing your worldview and saying, here is what I think, and there is value in what I think, and I'm allowed to think what I think, and I'm allowed to go on the internet and say what I think, and you can agree with it or not. And I think it's about trying to basically like find your people. Like, you can't find people who agree with you, who are part of like your tribe, have like-minded interests and things like that, if you're unwilling to say, here are my positions, here are my absolute lines in the sand that we won't cross. And so, I mean, I will not do this YouTube thing where I will not do debates, this whole debate bro culture thing. It really confuses me because no one is ever convinced in a debate. It's just about trying to own and destroy the other side. So anytime someone asks me to have a discussion or something, I always tell them, I'm not going to debate you. I do not care if you agree with me. I do not care if your audience agrees with me. But I will have a discussion with you explaining my point of view. And if I convince people, great. If I don't convince people, that's fine too.
I've seen you being a bit debatey though.
Oh, I can get aggressive, but
you get into quite a lot of, for people who don't know you, we should say you get into quite a lot of, I wonder, you must be very stressful for you. Or do you just develop a thicker skin? Because I mean, I get on Twitter and I have a, you know, every now and then something will happen and people will be mean, what I think is being mean to me. And I get quite upset about it. Is it just water off a duck's back for you now?
With me, it's a little bit different because, so I've been canceled quite a bit on Twitter. I've probably been canceled half a dozen times in like the last year and a half just by various groups. And there's a difference between like mean tweets from people I don't know and actual harassment. And I actually experienced both on Twitter. So Twitter is probably my most fiery platform. I think with mean tweets from people I don't know, even if I get them in the thousands, which has absolutely happened, that doesn't really bother me as much, but I tend to be more fiery on Twitter against a very targeted group of people, because it is a funny thing when you become a content creator, because people will start to live to hate you. I don't know if you've experienced this yet, and I genuinely hope you never do, but I literally have a horde on people, of people on Twitter who stalk me every single day, who retweet everything I say, who have, it's actually gotten pretty severe lately. They've tried to break up my marriage. They doxed a friend of mine last week.
What's doxing?
They released, he goes by a stage name publicly, and they did some sort of background check on him and discovered his given name that he uses, his legal name, and they doxed him on Twitter, which actually ended up, it could have put him in danger had the wrong people seen that.
Doxing just meaning giving out someone's real address and real name.
Exactly, giving out private information that they're not allowed to have. And so so that's, if people see me being fiery on Twitter, like that's really the audience that I tend to be fiery at, because they're actively trying to destroy my life. And I believe in standing up for yourself and saying, no, you are not the good guys. I'm not going to allow this. And I believe that, you know, we teach people how to treat us at the end of the day. So I don't seek out dramatic situations like that. But if I find myself in them, I will absolutely step up and defend myself.
When you say cancelled, do you mean just people have piled on, a pile on, they've been having it, or do you mean like you've lost, because cancelled typically means, you know, losing work and that kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, all of the above. Contracts that I've had canceled. I actually got canceled after Donald Trump retweeted me in 2020 when Trump was still on Twitter. It was funny, I was actually in the middle of delivering on a training contract to a nonprofit. And then Donald Trump retweeted me, and then they emailed me a couple days later saying, we no longer need you to complete this contract.
No.
But I had a cancellation clause in the contract where if they canceled after I started the engagement, they had to pay me the full fee anyway. So I was like, this is great. 25% of the work, 100% of the money. Thank you for this cancellation.
Still feels a bit bad though.
It does. I mean, it was a little bit disappointing for me, but at the same time, it's kind of like, do you really want to work with people who don't want to work with you? No, I mean, I think there are a million clients in the world, so I can just go work with someone else. I'm fine. And especially if I was paid 100% of the money, I didn't really lose out on anything. I think that they're the ones who lost out.
I've been told often by TV production companies, and I think we'll talk about this later on your show as well, that they want to take my ideas for documentaries and everything, but they want me to be behind the camera. And they literally say in this very vague, ambiguous way, just because we would like somebody from a minority to be on the screen. And that's like really hurtful. And I think part of it is just somebody saying, and I know what you're saying, do you want to work with someone who doesn't want to work with you? And it's ridiculous. But when it's like, you know, it's the BBC and the channel, you know, these channels you look up to or you did look up to before, it's really painful. And more painful, I think, because, you know, I'm a Jewish person. I'm a person of Jewish persuasion, but I don't do all the stuff. But I see stuff that's anti-Semitic, you know, it's YouTube, you know, so I see stuff every single day. You this, you that, and you control this and you do that. And it's very hurtful. But none of it hurt as much as being told you can't do your job because you're white, and that, or because you're white, you know, you don't fit this color or whatever. We think you're good enough, but we don't. That was very, very painful in a way I didn't expect. Like, it hurt. So That's why I guess I'm digging deeper into the feelings you've had when people don't want to work with you.
I think it's jarring when it first happens, especially when it happens with people that, you know, the first cancellation I ever had, it was funny because so right after my Trump article went viral, you know, I had never gone viral like that on the internet. I had no idea about this world. I had no idea what was going on. And it was literally like, my head was spinning for days after that. I really did not even know which way was up because I was getting constantly bombarded with these notifications and all these influencers were reaching out to me and all this stuff. And I remember there was a moment where I was actually like an Orange Theory, like on the rower. And I started hyperventilating and having a panic attack while I was at the gym working out, just thinking about what was going on. Anyway, so I was watching Tim Pool had just launched his podcast right around the same time. And he had Jack Murphy on as his first ever guest. I promise we're not going to go down the Jack Murphy rabbit hole.
You'll have to explain who these people are. I know Tim Pool is a former Vice journalist who also moved from sort of lefty thing rightwards, but
Tim Pool is a phenomenally successful YouTuber, and his show now, I mean, he gets more views now than CNN does on an average day. He's phenomenally successful at what he does. But this was like right when he first started his show that has now come phenomenally successful, and Jack Murphy was one of his first guests. And don't worry about it. Don't Google Jack Murphy. That's the only advice I'm going to give you. Don't Google Jack Murphy. You'll regret it if you do. But Jack Murphy came on and he was talking about how he got fired from his job for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, having a picture taken of him that looked like he was engaging with like really bad people, I think like neo-Nazis or something. And it ended up getting reported back. Like he was at a protest where they happened to be and someone took a picture where they happened to be like in the same frame or something. And it ended up getting reported to his job. And he said enough on that show where you wouldn't know it if you were just like a normal person. But I started to pick up on the fact that the business that canceled him was one of my current clients. And this is not like a big company, right? This is a small little organization that I had been doing training for them. I had been doing consulting for them. I had already been promised work from them in 2020. They were people that I really liked working with. I had a great relationship with their head of HR. And so it was like, I just had this article go viral. My head was spinning. I was just like, my life was turned upside down. And then this was the moment where I figured out I was going to be canceled. When I saw Jack Murphy talking on Tim Pool about how he had been fired from this organization, I was like, oh my God, this organization is a current client of mine. And sure enough, a couple months later, this organization did end up canceling me. And they canceled me because I said, during the very beginning of the pandemic, I was calling COVID Kung Flu, which I think is hilarious. I think it's hilarious to call COVID Kung Flu. I'm sorry. But like, I got an email from them saying that I was just being a little too racist and maybe, and they couldn't allow me to train with their people because I was being a little too racist. But if I wanted to have a conversation with them and apologize and repent for my online racism, then perhaps we could move forward. And I basically emailed them back and I said, well, I kind of knew this was going to happen as soon as I met Jack Murphy, knowing that I was getting my final dig in. But I mean, it did hurt. her, it was like, it's like you work for something your entire life and then you make a joke online that is a funny joke, I'm sorry, by like any measure of a joke, and it costs you your livelihood. But I mean, also, I've been doing this for, probably going on like 2.5 years now. And one of the things that I've learned is that you will only be canceled if you allow yourself to be. You can come back from anything. And I think I have a much different perspective on the situation now than I did before, because I've just come back from it so many times. And I mean, listen, man, like if Will Smith can slap the hell out of someone live at the Academy Awards and still have people on his side, then anyone can come back from anything. And I think it's this fear of being canceled and this fear of not being able to make a living or not being able to do what you love that prevents people from speaking out. And the most important thing that any of us can be doing right now, I think, are speaking out and standing up for ourselves and expressing what we believe. So, you know, that's just the road I've decided to take.
I'm definitely speaking out a little bit more. And I think there has been a slight change in the last few months, particularly around some of the trans ideology stuff, because people are a little bit, I've noticed just a little bit more, okay, you know. And I think it started with the Leah Thomas thing, because who's the swimmer who was a trans person who was just winning this race by like 50 laps. It was insane. Obviously not really 50, but a lot of laps, and stopping, you know, the biological women from being able to get scholarships and things like that, making a huge difference in their lives. And Leah Thomas as a man before was finishing, like, you know, still a strong swimmer, but not in the top spots at all. And I think that changed things, because before there was that New Zealand weightlifter who wasn't very good anyway and was in their 40s or 50s, was never going to win stuff, but Leah Thomas actually was going to. So I think that's actually changed stuff, and we can actually see that, whereas the stuff happening in prisons and, as you say, classrooms and things, we don't really see. You can very easily see what was happening in that swimming race, and it doesn't, the optics aren't great. That Kung Flu joke, I wonder, there's a lot of like, I think there's a bit of white saviorism or orientalism going on. And it's just like, I'm sure Chinese people make jokes like that about us. And like, there's a lot of stuff, it reminds me of what's going on in Latino communities, how we speak about Latino communities and the language and using Latin with the X at the end. You know, I lived in Argentina for quite a few years. And like, most of the people there don't want that. They think that's ridiculous. And their president, Cristina Kirchner, former president, who is not exactly a role model, but when they had the Chinese ambassador there, she made a similar joke, but she was actually greeting the Chinese ambassador, and she tweeted, the word for rice, I think, she tweeted like arroz, but she changed it to like alos because they could not be able to pronounce the R or whatever, which is a silly joke. I think yours is actually much better than that. But she's the president of a country. So we just assume that all these other countries have the same sensibilities that we do. And it's just so, you know, they've got a sense of humor in China. They've got a sense of humor in Argentina and all these different places. Like this white savior thing of like, oh, they're all victims. I think that's offensive. You know?
Oh, I think it's incredibly offensive. I think it's incredibly offensive that these people are trying to teach young Black children in school that they cannot be successful in the world unless white people allow them to be successful. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, one of the very first things that goes when people get sucked into this woke ideology is their sense of humor. They're literally no longer able to take a joke or even tell a joke. And it's incredibly depressing. I mean, I've watched my friends get sucked into this woke rabbit hole, people who were normal just a couple years ago. And it's like they all of a sudden become shells of themselves. It's like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. They become pod people.
They also no longer feel empathy for anything that doesn't relate to that particular cause, which I think is quite cult-like. And a friend of, I remember my first sort of fallout, and I haven't had many. I only had like this one really. And then I thought, you know what? I'm just not going to talk about this with friends who disagree. I'm just going to ignore them or just not have the conversation. But it was a woman I know, an American from DC or somewhere like that. And she said, why aren't you doing the documentaries anymore? So I told her what I told you about, you know, they didn't want, you know, and she just, her answer to that wasn't like, oh, that's sad. Her answer was, right, well, that's racist of you. And I was like, of me? And she was like, yeah, like, why do you even care about that? There's a genocide going on in the States right now.
Oh my God. Oh, there's a genocide going on in the States? When was there a genocide?
It was right around the BLM stuff when that was kicking off. And she said, and she used the word Holocaust as well. She was like, there is a Holocaust. And I was just like, I can't have this conversation.
That's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. Black Lives Matter did over $2 billion of property damage. It's just like, isn't it funny though to watch? I mean, I'm sure she's a very smart person, but isn't it funny to watch very smart people absolutely just invent stories out of nowhere that you're like, that's not quite true? And I mean, I think, like, you know, going back to kind of like where we started, like I would say you are red-pilled because you can see through that stuff, right? The people who are not, like, who believe everything the media tells them, those are people like your friends who are just completely inventing these fantasies out of nowhere that have no basis in reality at all. And if you can see through it, you're red-pilled.
It really upset me at the time. And you just got to move on, don't you? So tell me a bit about Actively Unwoke.
Actively Unwoke is a book I have coming out on May 10th. It's the ultimate guide for fighting back against woke insanity in your life. You know, I try to make fighting back against the woke fun because I think this is like a long-term fight to be able to regain, but turn back what I think is a cultural revolution that's taking place in the country. And so what I do in the book is I spend the first couple of chapters breaking down what is the woke ideology, what is critical race theory, what is the oppression hierarchy or the progressive stack, whatever you want to call it, and how does this stuff show up in the real world? And I do it in plain English because it's an incredibly complex topic, and that's intentional because people want they want people to be confused. They want people to not know what's going on, and you really have to decode the language. It really is like learning how to speak another language because the woke use language in a completely different way than like you or I would use exactly the same words. So you have to decode it and let people know what they mean. Then I provide a whole bunch of case studies on fighting back of like real people who have stood up and done the right thing. Like I provide a case study on Gabrielle Clark, who was a mom in Nevada who sued her son's school because the school tried to make her son, who is biracial, he's not white, but the school tried to make him admit he was an oppressor as a requirement to graduate. And when it was challenged, the school was like, nope, he's got to admit he was an oppressor in order to graduate. And so they ended up suing the school, and it was the first ever lawsuit against critical race theory in the public schools in the United States.
It's so culty, isn't it? You have to say these particular words. Even sometimes some people might want, sometimes I know they're expecting me to say a thing and like I actually agree with the thing, but I don't want to say it because I'm not going to like do you a favor and say your thing. I don't force you to say a thing. I would never do that. I'm not going to be in your cult, man. That's the culty stuff about it.
And well, that's what people don't understand a lot. It's like, you know, take the example of Joe Rogan and that clip that came around a couple months ago of him just saying really racist things. And he was saying racist things. Like, let's just be honest. What Joe Rogan said was not okay. But Joe Rogan never should have apologized.
Katie Herzog was saying about that, like, that people have got this like collective amnesia a bit because she, and I'm not sure how true this is or not, but she was saying that, it's only recent that the N-word has been totally inappropriate to say, that although it was inappropriate 10 years ago, you did still see people using it a little bit more, especially when talking about the use of the N-word. And I even saw the other day, you won't know of him, I don't think, but he's a British comedian called Stuart Lee, who is known as the lefty, probably quite woke comedian, who, you know, he is that guy. And it was from like only 10 years ago, and he used the word just at some stand-up gig that he was doing. And that made me think, oh, maybe it was a little... I mean, it was always bad, but maybe people did use that. And the F word for gay people as well. These are words that are now like totally... You cannot say them even if you're scientifically picking them apart, which is another debate to have. But that 10 years ago, it wasn't quite that level. And so the Joe Rogan stuff, he's done, what, 400 episodes... Or thousands, sorry. He's done thousands and thousands of episodes. And each one's 3 hours long. You pick out the moments from there. I don't want to completely defend him, but do you know what I mean?
No, totally. And I think there's more rationalization to be had around that than there was about, didn't he make a joke about like just being in a neighborhood and he called some monkeys or yes. Gorilla? Yeah. And that was, I was like, dude, that like crossed the line. Like you shouldn't have made that joke.
Seemed bad.
That seemed bad. But Joe Rogan never should have apologized, because the thing of it is that like, even if you're wrong and you can look back at that moment and say, you know what? not my best call, not my best decision. That was wrong. You still can't bend the knee to the woke, because that's what they do to try to get power over you. And this is what a lot of people don't understand, because again, you think that, you know, oh, I'm apologizing for something that I did was wrong and it caused harm to people and it hurt someone's feelings or whatever. Of course I would apologize. That's a very normal, rational human being thing to do. But you're not dealing with normal, rational human beings when you're dealing with a cancel mob that's saying, say the words we want you to say or else. And what people need to understand is, like, the minute that you give in to them that one time, even if the apology was merited, the minute you give in to them once, they will always have power over you, and they will always want something more and then something else and then something else, and it will never stop. And so the policy really should be, like, do not apologize ever, even if you think you're wrong. Or delay the apology until after the cancel mob is dispersed and been like, you know what, I wouldn't say that again, but I'm not bending the knee to these people. They get no power over me. And that really is the only way you can maintain your autonomy.
It's quite a toxic thing, isn't it? I often look at, like, the sort of the whole community. I'll compare it to, like, a relationship, just with a girlfriend or boyfriend, husband, wife, that kind of thing. And I'm always thinking, I've said this before on a podcast about, like, you know, we try to think of how 70 million people in the UK can all agree. It's hard enough just to agree, two of you, or just a friend, you and a friend. You go to a park and, oh, do we want to go to that part of it? Do we want to go to the museum? Like, that's impossible. So how do you do with 70 million people? And another thing that is, you know, fairly not very nice in relationships is when one person wants the other one to apologize. It goes from being like, I'm the victim, to like, I'm making you apologize. It does become a bit of a power move. And it's like one thing to, okay, I'm gonna cede power to my wife or husband or whatever because I was wrong and I hurt them. But as you say, like, I'm gonna cede power to this bunch of thousands of strangers. Like, nah, screw that. What's the point? There's a little bit like that Kevin Hart thing. I think it's Kevin Hart, because he made comments that were homophobic. And again, it was this thing of, like, 15 years ago, that was generally more accepted in society. Doesn't mean they're not bad. Doesn't mean that he shouldn't apologize to his friends or whatever if he wants to. But he did apologize. But then they resurfaced, the tweets resurfaced, you know, 15 years later when he was supposed to be hosting the Oscars or whatever it was. And the Oscars were like, well, we need you to apologize. And he was like, I did 15 years ago. And they were like, well, we need you to do it again publicly so that you can host the whatever. And he was like, I'm not doing that. I just refuse. And he didn't do it.
Yeah. And good for him for not doing it. And I think people have to be very honest when these situations come up. Is like, do you have any interest in maintaining a relationship with someone that clearly just wants power over you? Like, if I get in a fight with my husband and I'm legitimately wrong, I have a vested interest in trying to do what I can to fix that relationship, because I really like my husband. You know, he does things for me. He makes me happy. I'd like to keep him around for a little while. And so I don't want that relationship to be destroyed. And so fine, I will apologize if I'm wrong in that circumstance. But I think a lot of times people are conned into apologizing when they haven't done anything wrong, or they haven't done anything to deserve it. And you just have to weigh the balance of it. Like, do you really care about having a relationship with these people? And are you willing to suffer the consequences of maintaining your dignity and not apologizing?
Thank you to Karlyn Borisenko for coming on the show. And thank you, listeners, or edgehogs, as one wonderful listener proposed, for your continued support and attention. I hope you enjoyed listening to Karlyn. Whether or not you fully agree with her, it's all about listening to ideas with curiosity over judgment and making up your own minds. Do get her book, Actively Unwoke. Follow her on Twitter on Dr. Karlyn B. And subscribe to her namesake YouTube channel. She's had me on a couple of times, so check that out. What do you think about libertarianism? What do you think about those bears I talked about at the beginning? Let me know on @AndrewGold_OK on Twitter or Instagram. Please leave a review of this podcast on Apple or Castbox. I had a great one from Jenna S., who gave 5 stars on Apple in the UK. She wrote, I've been listening almost since the beginning and have only just figured out how to leave a review. I listen to a lot of podcasts, but this is the only one where I enjoy every episode. I love your self-deprecating humor. I sometimes wonder if American listeners actually think you're not that clever. I thought you were funnier than David Baddiel... Well, I'll certainly take that. David Baddiel is very funny. And if you haven't heard that episode, go back and see that David Baddiel on here. He's a British comedian who talks about how Jews have fallen off of the woke hierarchy and progressive hierarchy and all that stuff. But he's also very funny and has some scatological humor to throw in there. Why not? I think most American listeners do indeed get the self-deprecating humor, but there are always some who don't, and they get in touch and say, you should big yourself up more because you lack confidence and that's unappealing, or some such thing. I remember Ricky Gervais talking about how that is the biggest difference between Americans and Brits, who, to be honest, despite talking about differences all the time, are actually fairly similar as far as cultures go around the world. But yes, Gervais said that the biggest difference is that it is far more socially acceptable to big oneself up in the US and to be aspirational and ambitious. Those things are considered bad words in the UK to some extent. It's not that we're not allowed to be aspirational or ambitious, it's just that we are supposed to hide it even more than, you know, in some parts of polite society in the US. Personally, I find myself better able to get on with people who can make jokes at their own expense, but it's all about personal preference, isn't it? In any case, thanks for joining me on the edge. I hope this was an interesting look at libertarianism and the other side and all this kind of thing. And I'll see you next time, my beautiful, beautiful edgehogs.